This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
Right before Ivan was executed, he addressed the families of the people that were murdered and said, "I want you to know that I did not kill them. Texas murdered him."
Ivan Cantu and his legal team were unable to save his life from the Texas death chamber. Cantu had maintained his innocence for over 20 years.
The number of journalists who have lost their jobs, it's astounding. It's over 60% of the workforce.
Over the last 10 years, hedge funds, including Alden Global Capital, have purchased newspapers, laid off tens of thousands of journalists, and sold off the paper's properties.
When the workers organized under the new union, the bosses and the old union joined forces and called in the police, the military, the marines, water cannons, tanks, and even helicopters.
Turkish workers who make garments for Levi's denounce sweatshop conditions and union busting.
We Americans have to understand the implications that whatever the World Court rules against Germany will apply to the Biden administration in spades.
Nicaragua has filed a case at the International Court of Justice against Germany for providing support to Israel as it commits genocide against the Palestinians. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. On February 28th, the state of Texas executed Ivan Cantu, despite repeated legal efforts to save his life. Last year, Republican State District Judge Benjamin Smith withdrew his court order for Cantu's execution, stating that the new arguments required further review. After a brief pause, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals dismissed Cantu's request for an evidentiary hearing without considering its merits. According to the Texas Tribune, two jurors from Cantu's 2001 double murder trial supported his appeals, which claim that prosecutors relied on false testimony and withheld crucial evidence. Cantu was sentenced to death for the 2000 murder of his cousin and his cousin's fiancée, James Mosqueda and Amy Kitchen. He has maintained his innocence for over 20 years. Longtime death penalty abolitionist Gloria Ruback and others were outside the Huntsville prison to protest Cantu's execution.
This is Gloria Ruback with the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement in Houston, Texas, reporting about the legal lynching of Ivan Abner Cantu, Wednesday, February 28th in Huntsville, Texas, the execution capital of this country. When we got to Huntsville to protest the execution, we weren't quite sure it was going to happen. But after a few minutes, we found out that every court had turned Ivan down. His attorney made a decision not to appeal to the Supreme Court. The Board of Texas Pardons and Paroles had turned down his clemency, 7-0, and Governor Abbott had done nothing. So the execution was going to proceed at 6 o'clock. Ivan became the 587th person executed by Texas since 1982 in what they call the modern era, after the Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty. There was a large crowd outside of the death house in Huntsville because of all the publicity countrywide and actually internationally that this case had received. Due to Sister Helen Prejean, the author of Dead Man Walking and MoveOn.org, his case was promoted everywhere. In fact, Sister Helen and Ivan's mother, Sylvia Cantu, the week before, took boxes of signed petitions to the district attorney in Collin County, where Ivan was convicted, asking that DA to look at the evidence, to let his conviction integrity unit look at the new evidence that had been discovered since he was tried, and stop the execution until that happened. On the 28th, the execution did proceed. After every court, every political entity in Texas, and every politician denied looking at the new evidence that was discovered by an investigator who did a podcast, actually, called Cousins by Blood. And Ivan was accused of killing his cousin and his cousin's fiance. So on Wednesday, February 28th, in Huntsville, Texas, at the Huntsville unit in downtown Huntsville, the execution proceeded at 6 o'clock. Standing with 40, 50 of us who were protesting was one of Ivan's cousins and his cousin's daughter. There was actually two classes there, one from Sam Houston State University, which is literally a block or two away from the death house, and then a class that came from Abilene, Texas, because they were horrified at what was taking place. Ivan had visited with his mom, his girlfriend, his family before the execution and did not want any of them to witness. He wanted them to have their last memories of him talking with them and laughing and enjoying each other's company. But Sister Helen Prejean from Louisiana was his spiritual advisor, and she was the only one in there with him. I believe some of the victims' families were also in the execution chamber. But Sister Helen stood with her hand, holding his hand, and talking to him. Texas murdered him, and the time of death was 6:47 p.m. Ivan was executed by a one-drug cocktail that was given to him with an IV. And for some reason, even though most states have stopped executing because they can't get execution drugs, Texas seems to have found a good drug dealer. And the other thing they do is the drugs that they've had for years, they keep changing the expiration date on them. So he was given, I think it's phenobarbital is a drug that is used. Other states have now started using suffocation by nitrogen and the electric chair and firing squads. We're kind of going back in history. But right before Ivan was executed, he addressed the families of the people that were murdered and said, "I want you to know that I did not kill them. And if I knew who did, you would have been the first people to get any information I would have had, so we could have had justice for my cousin James and his girlfriend Amy." And he thanked his attorney, Gina Bunn. He thanked his mom, Sylvia Cantu, and he thanked Matt Duff, who was the investigator that uncovered all the evidence that didn't happen in trial. And he told everybody to keep up the fight, keep searching for answers, and hopefully at some point the families will get true closure. Sister Helen Prejean, who witnessed the execution, issued a statement. She spent the day following the execution with Ivan's mother, and this is what she said. "Today, February 29th, I'm spending the day with Ivan's mother, Sylvia, herself a valiant, faith-filled woman. When word came to her of her son's death last night, the people with her in a house near the death house could hear her loud, sustained wail of grief throughout the whole house. Now, along with the victim's family, another mother is mourning her dead child. I return to New Orleans tomorrow, and I will be glad to leave Texas, the biggest killing state in the country." She said, "Although we didn't save Ivan, the spotlight we placed on the injustices in his case reverberated in the media both here and overseas. It is so rare to see such critical coverage of a Texas execution. Thanks to all of you who acted to try to save Ivan and to expose the flaws in the Texas justice system." Ivan was tried in 2021. His court-appointed lawyer did not call a single witness for Ivan. In fact, when he addressed the jury, he told them Ivan was guilty. And Ivan jumped up from his chair and he told the judge, "Your Honor, I'd like to fire this attorney. I never said I was guilty and I'm not." And the judge denied that and told him to sit down. The new evidence that was discovered was they said his fingerprints were on the gun. No, they were not. They were on a cartridge that somebody put inside the gun, and probably the same person that left some bloody jeans with the victim's blood in the middle of Ivan's apartment. The police searched his apartment right after the murder. The gun was not there, and those jeans were not there. And in fact, the jeans were a size 34. Ivan was skinny. He wore a size 29 or 30 jeans. A 34 would have literally fallen off of him. Also, the two main witnesses against Ivan lied in their testimony, and the DA knew they were lying. One of them, actually a year or two ago, told the DA, "You knew that I was not telling the truth, and I'm here to tell the world now. I recant everything I said. In fact, I was on drugs and so high when I testified, I'm not even sure what I said." So these are just some of the things that have come out since his trial. The other thing that rarely happens is that three people who had been on his jury came out and said, "Whoa, we did not have all the information." And the jury foreman named Jeff Calhoun spoke at a press conference that Sister Helen Prejean had on February 22nd outside of the DA's office in Collin County. But a few days before the execution, he wrote an op-ed piece in the Austin American Statesman. And in that, he told Governor Abbott, "Please disregard that form I signed because this case isn't over. There still needs to be evidence looked at." His op-ed piece was titled, "I helped put Ivan Cantu on death row. Now I feel like I was fooled." So Ivan became the 587th person executed since the death penalty was reinstated in 76. And a little over 1,500 people have been executed since then in the United States. Out of those 1,500, almost 1,300 were executed in a former Confederate state. The racism involved with the death penalty is linked inextricably to capital punishment. It cannot be separated. It's like when you mix the Kool-Aid with the water. You can't ever get that Kool-Aid back. That's how racism and the death penalty are. Just recently, one of the most well-respected web pages, the Death Penalty Information Center, based in Washington, D.C., put something on their webpage that I was actually shocked by. After they talk about all the people that have been executed, they have a section called Executed But Probably Innocent or Likely Innocent. And they list 20 people in this country who were most likely innocent, but were executed anyway. Ivan's name is going to have to be added to that. But this is what shocked me. Out of the 20 people that they mention, 10 of those 20 were in the state of Texas. I knew many of those 10, but I could also name another 10 that I know personally who were executed and innocent. Francis Newton, Odell Barnes, Joseph Nichols, Carlos Santana. I mean, a bunch of people. Just last year, Arthur Brown. The death penalty system is broken. It cannot be fixed. There are errors everywhere you look at it. My organization, the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement, issued a press release that day. And in it, we quoted one of our activists, and I'll end by saying what he said. "It is appalling that no court will stop the haste of Texas to execute Ivan Cantu without even considering new evidence that has been discovered since his original trial. From Cantu's incompetent court-appointed attorney at trial to the main witnesses giving perjured testimony to the DA hiding evidence, We demand that this execution be stopped and that a new trial be held. The racism in this system and the drive to kill by Texas is nothing short of criminal. This is Gloria Ruback reporting for Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I am with the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement and a reporter on the Prison Show with KPFT Pacifica Radio Houston. Follow us on our Facebook page, The THE Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. We're very active, and there's a lot of, more information than you even want to know about what's going on with the Texas death penalty.
Now, more than ever, all family must be together. Every brother, everywhere, feels the time is in the air. Common blood flows through common veins, and the common eyes all see the same. Now, more than ever, all the family must be together.
Peace go with your brother. Though I ain't so proud anymore. Peace go with your brother. Recognition don't come cheap anymore. All I can say is peace. Peace go with your brother.
That was Gil Scott-Heron. Peace go with you, brother. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Over the last 10 years, hedge funds like Alden Global Capital have purchased newspapers, laid off tens of thousands of journalists, and sold off the newspaper's properties. Rick Goldsmith is the editor and producer of Stripped for Parts, a new film about this wrecking operation. He spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Hedge funds and private equity have gotten into newspapers in about the mid-200s, 2005, 2006. Newspapers, that was about the time that newspapers started to struggle financially back in the 20th century and before. It was a great place to get rich. You could also be engaged with the community, and most of the media moguls back then were engaged in some way, shape, or form, but it was also a great profit machine, and that ceased to happen in the first decade of this century. So that's when the hedge funds started getting in, and Alden Global Capital, this particular hedge fund, got into newspapers about 2010. Dean Singleton, a media mogul who owned the Denver Post and about 100 other papers, the Denver Post was their flagship. He was taking it on the chin for, financially. And so he found himself in the position where he was going to have to file for bankruptcy, and he had to get rid of the paper. And there didn't seem to be other media moguls that wanted to get into it, but the hedge funds did. And that's what precipitated this chain of hedge funds and private equity buying up newspapers and newspaper chains, selling off the real estate, and cutting the staff, and turning the newspapers into really less than journalism machines. And it was horrible for the people that worked for them because they got layoffs or buyouts, and more than that, for the communities they served.
We're talking about media monopolies because there's been an ongoing mergers and monopolization of the media, both TV and the newspapers. Aren't there rules against that in the United States?
Well, there is legislation that can be put into effect, but it needs the political will. The antitrust legislation could be used against hedge funds and private equity, but it hasn't been. There was legislation back in 2019 that was proposed by Senator Warren, Stop Wall Street Looting Act, which would have affected the rules against, let me step back a second. hedge funds and private equity, they are not subject to the kind of regulation, SEC filings, transparency of all kinds, that regular newspaper companies and regular corporations are subject to. So this Stop Wall Street Looting Act would have instituted more regulations on hedge funds and made it more difficult for them to snap up newspapers singly and snap up newspaper chains. So there's a lot of government regulation that could be used or could be put into effect that hasn't been done yet, but it's kind of up to us to push on that chain to make these things happen.
And how many newspapers have been shut down, say, in the last 20 years, and how many reporters have been laid off? Do you have any figures on those?
The figures of in the last 20 years, something like 2,000 or 2,500 newspapers have shuttered in the country. Most of the takeovers by hedge funds and private equity have resulted not in shutting down the newspapers, as people projected would happen in 2 to 3 years, but they are still profit machines for the hedge funds. And we could kind of go into, it's a counterintuitive, how can you make money out of distressed industries? But that's the genius of these hedge funds with their model of distressed asset investing. How many working journalists have been laid off? The number of journalists who have lost their jobs, it's astounding. It's over 60% of the workforce. So I don't remember the exact figures, but you're talking about figures something like 72,000 working paid journalists being reduced to something like 30,000 in the space of 15 to 20 years.
I mean, it sounds like the destruction of an industry. Is that really what's going on? They're destroying the industry? And
well, very much so. Yeah, very much so.
I know in the film, part of the film is about the efforts to get a good billionaire to buy a newspaper. We just had the situation in the Los Angeles Times where it was bought by a so-called good billionaire who was going
right.
to support it, and now they're laying off. That apparently did not work as far as looking for the good billionaire to help out the industry.
Well, I think there's several problems with that. The business model has collapsed. It's not collapsing. It's not on the verge of. It has collapsed. The newspapers as print vehicles used to sell their advertising to advertisers. Macy's or your car dealership and the classified ads were a big, big source of income. And, you know, beginning with Craigslist and then with the switch to digital, that model ceased to work. So the billionaires that are, as you say, are good billionaires that hold newspapers like in Minneapolis or in Boston, John Henry, they work to some extent because they want to keep their doors open, but they're losing money too, or they're not making as much money as they would like to. And it's only a matter of time. You know, there's maybe three newspapers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal, who have a business model that work. And that's because they're national newspapers and their base has actually expanded in the digital age. But for 99.9% of the newspapers in the country, their base has shrunk because they've had to switch to digital. The advertising dollars are not available in digital at all. And they're further being gobbled up by Google and Facebook, who have these kind of sweetheart deals. They knew how to manipulate the legislation and so forth to work to their advantage and kind of beat the newspapers out of a certain amount of money. But the business model hasn't really worked. And so to look for a quote unquote good billionaire to run a newspaper is kind of folly to begin with, because it's not something that really works.
And the issue of the newspaper workers running the industry, newspapers running newspapers, El Humanité used to be run by newspaper, the journalist. What do you think about that idea? Because they're actually producing the product, the news, that is then being sold.
Well, there are 1,000 flowers blooming right now. So all over the country, there are experiments that happen. In our film, the first kind of triggering episode was an editorial that was written by the editorial writer of the Denver Post, criticizing his hedge fund owner. And that set off a wave, a triggering of outrage around the country. It was on the front page of the New York Times and the front page of the Washington Post and Esquire and Huffington Post and everything else. But what it also did was it prompted some of the senior editors and writers of that paper to be so fed up with what the Denver Post had turned into that they left the paper, eight of them left the paper and formed the Colorado Sun. And the whole purpose of that was they had this body of knowledge that between the eight of them, it's now expanded to 25 or 27 people. And they had that institutional knowledge. They were carrying it with them, and they were starting their own democratically run news organization. So it's that kind of thing. They're not flowering all over the country, but there are these small nonprofits, and there are at least 400 or so under one umbrella called the Institute for Nonprofit News, which each one of them has a different model. You know, one of them might have three people in the newsroom, another one might have 12. One of them might be focusing only on education or only on the state house or only on climate change. But all around the country, we live in an era where people are trying to figure out what is the next step so that we don't lose journalism, which is under attack. I think there's no issue more important than journalism because democracy depends on it. And I think we're at a position kind of like the environmental movement and climate change was, where, you know, 40 years ago, there was a few scientists and people who, you know, they were talking it up, but the tree was falling in the forest and nobody was listening. It wasn't making a sound. And then gradually that took hold in communities. That's what's happening now. We are at that moment with journalism. The journalists themselves were the first ones to sound the alarm. And now that's beginning to become a wildfire of action.
That was Rick Goldsmith, the producer and editor of Stripped for Parts, speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. Last November, workers at Levi's clothes manufacturing plant in Urfa, Turkey, decided they'd had enough of the company's union and tried to establish a real class-based union. Turkey's laws allow them to do so, and the country's constitution also gives them this basic, simple right. Nevertheless, the plant's owners, the company union, governors, police, and the military joined forces against the 500 workers who were all fired, beaten, detained, arrested, and dragged into courts. The Levi Strauss Corporation is at the center of all these illegal attacks. Pacifica's Mehmet Bayram picks up this story.
Levi's promises and labor harassment at Levi's factories. It all started with trying to exercise a simple fundamental right of trying to choose a union that would defend the workers at Özak Textile in the town of Urfa, Turkey. Özak Textile is a business that manufactures clothes for the leading world brands such as Zara, Guess, Hugo Boss, and Levi's. They already had a union. The workers were already organized with the blessing of the bosses. The workers of Özak Textile had gathered under a company union, Özipekish. This union belongs to the Confederation of Religious, Pro-Government, Pro-Management, Conservative, Sellout, Hakish. It is hard to call it a union. Although the union managers collect their dues religiously every month, when it comes to representing the workers, this pro-management organization becomes the disciplinary organ of the factory owners. Last year in November, the workers had had enough of this union misrepresentation in the face of unbearable working conditions. They had a legal right to choose any union they wanted. That is when the gates of hell opened up. Urfa is a town in the southeastern part of Turkey, bordering Syria. The area is known for its deep religious affiliations, conservatism, and strong support for the pro-Islamic government of Tayyip Erdogan. It is known as the area of prophets, where people believe many prophets have lived since Abraham. The pro-business Erdogan government has used this religious conservatism and the traditional tribal patriarchal associations to secure a reliable voter base at all times. With its strong ties to the government and religious sects that are rampant in the region, the Yellow Union, as they are called in Turkey, the business union, had the workers feeding from his hands, or that's what they thought. Özal Textile has grown exponentially in the Urfa region and other parts of the country in the past few years. It has signed up world brands like Levi's, Zara, and others. The company prides itself on trying to achieve more perfection every time on its website. But of course, this was only possible with the great support it received from the central Erdogan government. When the Turkish government decided to make Turkey the Bangladesh of the Middle East, that is, the slave-running center of the region, it bestowed all its resources on creating top-down millionaires who would exploit the captive labor market. These local capitalists were given free land, government subsidies, government loans, tax-free income, reduced or free utilities, and import tax breaks. The expense of setting up a factory was nearly zero for these free market entrepreneurs. Drooling over the low cost of production due to near slave wages, zero investment price, and a workforce kept under strict discipline by the pro-business, pro-government union, utilizing religion as the correcting device, Levi's and other international corporations jumped to grab a piece of the pie. It all went well for them until the workers could not bear the exploitation they were subjected to. In a remarkable display of courage and conviction, the workers rejected the union that had traditionally represented their political party. They sought a new path, a progressive, leftist, independent union that they believed would honestly represent their interests. They reached out to Birteksen, the United Textile Weaving and Leatherworks Union, placing their trust in a leader who had proven himself as a genuine advocate for their class. Talking to Mehmet Türkler, the fighting unionist, he explained the reasons why the workers decided to change from the so-called union to Birteksen to fight for them.
Son derece ağır oldu. İşçiler üzerinde baskı, mobbing, işte tazminatsız işten atma ve benzeri pek çok uygulamanın olduğu.
Quote, "This textile factory operates so that most workers work for a minimum wage. However, more than the wages, the working conditions are very heavy. Workers are subject to high stress, mobbing, which is organized pressure from management, firings without paying severance, etc. Women workers are especially targeted. Just imagine, they need to come in at 8 a.m. and work till 2 or 3 a.m. in the morning. Then they have to go home to sleep for 3 hours, but return back to work at 8 the next morning. And this happens several days a week and continues every week. If anyone complains, they are immediately fired or find themselves facing further mobbing and pressures. We are talking about a plant where even the senior workers who have been at this factory for 12, 13 years work at minimum wages. As you may know, the minimum wages here are already very low compared to other minimum wages in the world. Even the Government Statistics Institute has calculated the minimum wage to be at 55,000 liras. But what the workers here receive is around a quarter of this figure. And there's a union at this workplace. The Workers' Union has been organized at this workplace for 7 years and has done collective bargaining for 7 years. Unfortunately, however, they are like other unions that we call the Yellow Unions, a bureaucratic organization. So imagine, all these are happening in a unionized workplace. Workers are forced to work 18, 20 hours a day in a place that has a union. What the workers are forced to do is illegal, to start with. When the workers complain, the union puts pressure on them long before the bosses step in. When workers complain about any injustice or illegality, the union pulls them to the office and threatens them even before the management gets involved. It was at such a level that even the writing up of the workers was done by the union. These write-ups are a way to suppress the workers at a factory. It is one of the most efficient ways to exercise mobbing on the worker. A worker can be fired without severance after 3 write-ups. However, in these plants, the union representatives themselves write up the warning against workers. So we are talking about such a union. End of quote.
Yani işçiler üzerinde mobbing kurmanın en etkili yöntemlerinden biri tutanak tutmaktır.
When the workers organized under the new union, the bosses and the old union joined forces and called in the police, the military, the marines, water cannons, tanks, and even helicopters to prevent the workers from setting foot in the factory's neighborhood. All workers have been fired. Levi's knows about the dispute and has received reports from international monitoring groups. San Francisco-based corporation promised to pull orders from Özak. However, it keeps doing business as usual. Workers and the union in Urfa sent us the request to tell Levi's that they are complicit in these illegal operations. If they tell the bosses in Turkey, the workers will get their jobs back. No word or action has come from Levi's even after 450 workers have been fired and are struggling with unemployment. This breaches the international agreements and charters Levi's signed. For Capitalism, Race and Democracy, this is Mehmet Bayram reporting.
Ayrı gider oldum kardeşler ve de kız kardeşler. Gayrı gider oldum kardeşler ve de kız kardeşler. Gayrı haram bu can bana, bu toprak damlar, bu sevda bana, bu ağaçlar, bu caddeler haram bana. Gayrı haram bu sevda bana, bu toprak damlar, bu caddeler, bu ağaçlar, bu sevdalar haram bana. Oğuşak bir de karım, bir de bana haydin gittir. Kuş bana, yılan bana, haydin gittir. Yılan bana.
That was Ahmet Kaya singing Gayrı Gider Oldum. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race and Democracy. I'm Polina Vasiliev. Israel isn't the only nation being sued for violating the United Nations Genocide Convention. In what may also become a landmark case, on March 1st, Nicaragua filed a suit in the UN's International Court of Justice against Germany for aiding and abetting Israel's genocide in Gaza. Professor Francis Boyle, attorney and expert in human rights and international law, explains the importance of Nicaragua's case, including its relevance for charging other countries, such as the United States, for supporting Israel's ongoing genocide. Professor Boyle spoke to journalist Rachel Blevins.
Nicaragua sued Germany for aiding and abetting Israeli genocide against the Palestinians, and also for violating the Geneva Conventions, aiding and abetting Israeli violations of the Geneva Conventions against the Palestinians, and Germany violating its own obligation under the Geneva Conventions to respect and ensure respect. Nicaragua has asked for an emergency hearing by the court. The court is considering that now. I would suspect by the end of the week, we will have an order from the court as to that hearing. The Nicaraguans will get a hearing on this. I would guess, based on my experience dealing with the court and the previous case by South Africa, that hearing probably would be at the end of next week, say Thursday, Friday, perhaps the following week. I don't know. Nicaragua has asked for comprehensive provisional orders of protection against Germany, aiding and abetting any form of Israeli violations of the Genocide Convention and the Geneva Conventions. I've read the Nicaraguan pleadings and requests. They will win something. They will win some provisional measures of protection against Germany. It is hard to predict because there is no jurisprudential precedent for one state suing another state for aiding and abetting genocide by a third state. It's very hard to predict exactly what Nicaragua will get. You can read the list of requests they have made. I don't know what they'll get. I think all their requests are justifiable as a matter of international law, each and every one of them. But the court is not bound by Nicaragua's requests. They can take them into consideration and then give Nicaragua whatever requests they want. It will all depend on what a majority of the court can agree upon here. So we'll have to see what Nicaragua can come up here. I think it will have an impact on Germany. Nicaragua has also threatened to sue publicly, not verbal, Canada, Netherlands, and the United Kingdom. Right now, I don't think they will do that. I think they will wait and see what happens here. They don't have to sue those other states if they don't want to, because all the issues are properly presented in the lawsuit Nicaragua versus Germany. But clearly, whatever is decided there on Germany would apply to the Biden administration. The problem is the Nicaragua did not threaten to sue the Biden administration. The Biden administration is guilty of sin. There's no question at all about it, for aiding and abetting Israeli genocide against the Palestinians and also violation of the Geneva Conventions. However, the United States government made a reservation to Article 9 of the Genocide Convention, denying the jurisdiction of the World Court to hear complaints under the Genocide Convention without the consent of the United States government. So under those circumstances, Nicaragua did not threaten to sue the United States government. But certainly whatever is decided here in the case of Nicaragua and Germany would apply in spades to the Biden administration. That's for sure. Nicaragua, the current president, Daniel Ortega, a Sandinista, has no fear of suing the United States government. Remember, in the Reagan administration, Nicaragua sued the United States government for the Contra War at the World Court. And they won an order of provisional measures of protection. They won a judgment on jurisdiction and competence. And they won a final judgment on the merits, all within 2 years. And that was when Ortega was president. So I don't think they're afraid at all of the United States government here. But legally, in my opinion, if they made, as a lawyer, practicing lawyer, you have to investigate the facts and the law before you publicly threaten to sue someone. This is what we lawyers would call a demand letter. It's not a polite little, oh, by the way, it's a note verbal threatening a lawsuit. Now, I agree with the Nicaraguan decision here that, yes, Biden is guilty of sin. But because of the the U.S. government's reservation to Article 9, I think right now for Nicaragua to sue the United States would be a futile gesture. So I can understand why their lawyers decided not to threaten to sue the United States government. It makes perfect sense to me, yes. And I certainly don't criticize them for it. But we Americans have to understand the implications that whatever the World Court rules against Germany will apply to the Biden administration in spades. And of the states that Nicaragua threatened to sue, certainly Germany is the worst.
That was human rights attorney Frances Boyle speaking to journalist Rachel Blevins. That was Cortatu, Nicaragua Sandinista. Despite universal condemnation from the nearly 200 members of the United Nations, U.S. policy remains to try and starve Cuba into collapse, as it has for the past six decades. Pacifica's Don DeBar spoke to independent journalist Camila Escalante.
The CIA has been operating to induce inflation and other market problems into Cuba's economy. That, according to a report this week in the Cuban newspaper Granma, under a headline, U.S. Intelligence Services Operate Against Cuba's Finances. According to the article, the aims of the most recent onslaught by the CIA and its associated agencies was to attack the currency, generate hyperinflation, and contract production, altering the distribution of goods and diverting them to overpriced black markets, attacking the economic actions of the government. It describes a four-part strategy. For more on that, we go to Nicaragua to speak with journalist Camila Escalante, who has just returned there from a visit to Cuba. So, Camila, you've read this story and you just came back. What do you think?
This article is really interesting because it talks about the way in which U.S. intelligence continues to find ways to meddle in the Cuban economy using things like this platform. This Granma article names this platform called El Toque, that's used to stimulate inflation. El Toque is this this account on Telegram, essentially, and behind it are unknown individuals. This is exactly what happened in the case of Venezuela just some years ago. In that case, it was a Twitter account that every single day was coming out and announcing what the exchange rate was. And it wasn't, the official exchange rate being announced by a central bank or any authority or anything like that, but these mysterious people who say that they have some sort of method to put together all these different numbers based on some equation of all these different factors of people buying dollars on the market and exchanging and all that. And they come out with the real rate, which there's a discrepancy between this supposed real rate of exchange between the Cuban peso and the US dollar and what the rate, official rate is. And so this is something that Cuba now is saying that the United States is behind. And they say that the main objective of the CIA and its maneuvers is to manipulate the prices of products and, subvert order in this country.
Camille, I saw something like this 30-something years ago towards the end of the Soviet Union's life. And it was a process that took a number of years, apparently, beginning in the period known as détente, when tensions were actually lower and some commercial relations began to grow between the West and the Soviet bloc. They were kind of used as a period to introduce the Soviet markets to Western products and to instill, like we have here, whether officially or not, a secondary currency to the Soviet ruble, where people used dollars or pounds or marks or, whatever, instead of using rubles for some products. And they even had a separate retail network set up, stores that were called Berioska stores, where you could buy Western goods, but you needed a Western currency. This caused people to steal stuff from work that they could sell in a black market in exchange for Western currencies. Like the guy who drives the tomatoes from farm to market, half of them would fall off the truck on the way, and now he had money to go buy stuff in the Berioska store that he would then flip to somebody for rubles in the black market. And the economy kind of fell out through its rear end as a consequence of this, literally. That was kind of why all the stores ended up empty and the economy kind of fell apart. I haven't been to Cuba since 2019, and people seem to be, hanging in there pretty well considering it was a 60-year economic war going on against them. What's it like now? You just came back.
Well, the situation is much like it has been in recent years, but as the government has denounced on many occasions internationally, taking to the podium at the UN and in many other instances, things have gotten a lot harder since COVID-19. But it's not just because of COVID-19 and the lockdown and the shutdown of the tourism industry, but it's because new measures were imposed against Cuba by the Trump administration that have not been lifted by the Biden administration since. And also, Cuba was returned to the list of state sponsors of terrorism, which makes it very difficult to do trade with other countries. So the situation has really, really become quite difficult. Some numbers were released in the last week regarding the number of tourists, I believe, who've entered the country in recent months. Definitely it has bounced back, and they hope to see more of that. And it's so absolutely vital that tourism industry for bringing money into the country. But unfortunately, beyond those positive signs, like you said, it's really difficult with inflation due to, for, you know, various reasons related to the blockade and sanctions on Cuba, the difficulty in getting fuel. There have been fuel shortages in Cuba in recent years, and that has contributed to inflation. This is a country that relies on its close allies, Russia and Venezuela, in order to import fuel. And, you know, specific to the Cuban case, we know that there are three dozen countries that are subject to unilateral coercive measures, but Cuba is an island. And so in these countries, under the worst of economic conditions and sanctions, where it's very difficult to import specific goods and necessary products, a lot of times in other cases, in other countries, people have been able to still get those products very cheaply because of contraband moving over borders, which simply isn't possible in the case of Cuba because of its location.
So the first sanctions by the U.S. were imposed in October of 1960. In 2015, there was a report, a study that was published in Al Jazeera, that estimated the total embargo cost up to that time, that's, you know, now 8 years or 9 years ago, at about $1.2 trillion. $1.2 trillion. Now, Cuba has a population of about 12 million, which means each and every man, woman, and child has already been in Cuba right now, has already suffered a $100,000 loss.
It's absolutely, by definition, a genocidal blockade. Its aim is to starve the Cuban people. The Cuban people and their government have been able to, by and large, eradicate extreme poverty and homelessness. And they've also been able to reach a very high level of education, which is free up till university and beyond, post-grad sort of, you know, medical school and all of that, as well as, of course, they're bringing in people from other countries to teach. But at the same time, we're seeing a huge gap, although people are housed and they're able to, you know, purchase some very basic food products. We're moving towards a new era of technology, of AI, of all sorts of other things that simply is not reaching the island. It's very difficult. Cuba, just like the rest of Central America, where I am, you know, these countries have relied for many years, decades, largely their economies are relying on remittances from the exterior. Their family members go to live in different countries and they're able to send money, which amounts to just a massive chunk of the economy annually. And right now, the Cuban people, it's very difficult for them to, in any regular way, receive remittances. Western Union was shut down. Now they're able to use Western Union once again, but only between the United States and Cuba. You're not able to use it from other countries. It's basically the main service that people use anywhere in the world to be able to send money internationally. And so there are a lot of, you know, services that are being denied beyond just the products. They want to starve the people into to submission so that they'll renounce their own model. And so far, they've yet to do that. But unfortunately, it's up to the people of the United States who've done little in the face of this, these really what are atrocities and human rights violations on a massive scale now for decades.
That was independent journalist Camila Escalante speaking to Pacifica's Don DeBar. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Akua Holt, Steve Zeltzer, Mehmet Bayram, Don DeBar, Freddy Libertad, Ann Garrison, and myself, Paulina Vasiliev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button and follow us on X, formerly Twitter, @PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.